الفلسطيني بيشتغل في منطقة كثير خاصة.
The Palestinian journalist works in an area rich with events. There are incursions and airstrikes all the time. And as a journalist tries to cover these crimes, he will be a target to the Israeli occupation. The Israeli occupation does not want the journalist to succeed in covering these violations, because any footage that comes out of the Gaza Strip exposes the Israeli occupation's army. That is why, in the beginning of any incursion, they fire and attack journalists to get them away from the action zone so they cannot document these incursions or any targeting of civilians. Therefore, if they injure the journalist, he would be taken to the hospital and there will be no one to document the events so the occupation army can do whatever they want. If journalists were there, this means there were witnesses on the crime. There are no witnesses on the crime as long as there are no journalists. Palestinian journalists have been subject to a variety of violations that reach the killing in cold blood. Other violations include arrest and detention for extended periods, especially the administrative detention with no accusation, as well as confiscation of their media coverage badges, especially in the West Bank. Journalists face continuous violations similar to the case during their coverage of the war on Gaza or the usual occupation's incursions to the Palestinian areas. Many of them were injured while covering the events, and some of these injured journalists lost their ability to perform their job.
Assassination of journalists in general is part of the repulsive occupation because Palestinian journalists actually like the job, which unveils the ugly face of the occupation and have determination and persistence. The Israeli occupation just assassinates them. They kill them to kill the truth. This is how the occupation envisions killing and assassinating them.
During the attack on Jabalia, there was an incursion in Azbat Abd Rabbo right behind us. We were covering the incursion on the first and second day. It seems that the Israeli occupation army did not like our movement in the area, so they fired at us multiple times. But we continued documenting this crime. I was standing right here when the tanks advanced a little further. They saw me, and right away one of the tanks fired a shell directly towards me. After I was taken to the hospital, I was surprised that the shell also hit other people and they were killed. When I woke up and became conscious, I realized that my best friend and the rest of the team were also injured. After that, we went back to the field and continued working. These violations and targeting of journalists are not going to stop us from doing our work. By the way, this building we are in right now was hit and targeted by the Israeli occupation during the war on the Gaza Strip. Other colleagues were on the roof of this building and were targeted as well while covering the events. However, none of us, the journalists, our colleagues who were targeted, their families, or even the Palestinian Authority took judicial action. So there is weakness or failure in this side. We have to encourage families of victims, civil society organizations, the journalist syndicate, and the Palestinian Authority to take judiciary action against the Israeli occupation's war criminals. These Israeli war criminals should not remain unpunished.
We can generally say that these violations frequently committed by the Israeli occupation against Palestinian journalists are evidence that it tries to cover the truth and isolate Palestine from its surrounding. The occupation isolated the Gaza Strip through the siege, and isolates the West Bank from time to time. Despite all these hardships, Palestinian journalists played their role in delivering the message and suffering of Palestinian people, as well as documenting the violations that expose the Israeli occupation. Therefore, the camera was able to expose the organized terrorism, war crimes, and crimes against humanity committed by the Israeli occupation. Claims were filed on the issue of targeting journalists, especially those from Al-Aqsa Association, but procrastination has always prevailed in these cases. There were also claims by local and international organizations, but these also were put aside, especially the ones regarding Al-Aqsa Association. The justification given most of the time, among others, was that a counterclaim of the one presented is filed. This is evidence that there are restrictions on journalists and their claims, especially those from Al-Aqsa Association. The Israeli occupation is a renegade state practicing state terrorism according to the international humanitarian law. However, the balance of powers with the United States hegemony blocks any attempts to sue the Israeli occupation in the United Nations, especially in the Security Council. Using Article 7 of the international law would force the Israeli occupation to subdue and abide to the international conventions and the international humanitarian law. When the issue on the table concerns an Arab country or so, the United Nations decisions are enforced immediately, and forces like UNIFIL would deploy to employ decisions of the Security Council. In the Palestinian case, everything is pending and no serious sanctions were enforced to prevent the Israeli occupation from committing more crimes against Palestinians, and this provides a shield for the occupation to carry on.
Israeli occupation's violations presented a dangerous threat to the lives of many journalists while performing their job, as they were targeted with bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, and many of them were critically injured. During the war in 2009, the Israeli occupation targeted journalists and media facilities. One of the most important media companies targeted is the Media Group Company, which was directly targeted with a rocket.
Many of the journalists in Media Group Company were targeted on various occasions. One of our cameramen was targeted with a tank shell, and he almost got killed. During our coverage of the war on Gaza, end of 2008 and early 2009, the Media Group office was shelled. We were supplying coverage for 20 satellite channels and international news agencies. The place was shelled despite the lighting and the clear signs in Arabic, English, and Hebrew that there are journalists in this place. The Israeli occupation's shell, or rocket, fell only 8 meters away from us. Thanks to Allah. Otherwise, we would have been all dead. At some point, after the rocket hit the office, I did not feel any kind of pain. I started to wake up and look around the place. Everything was black, and I didn't know what happened to us and whether both the 13th and 14th floor were hit. Then little by little, we started to check on each other, and I turned out to be injured in my arm only, which is a relief. Then we found out that Ayman was hit in the head, so we tried to stop his bleeding and could barely carry him down the stairs from the 13th floor, and then put him in a car and took him to the hospital.
The Israeli occupation had not had enough terrifying and scaring civilians, but it continued the unjustified targeting of the media offices and facilities. Al-Aqsa TV channel, affiliated with Hamas, was directly targeted with rockets which made it stop its transmission, and this makes the violation reach the level of killing through both bullets and rockets.
Both Al-Aqsa TV channel and Al-Aqsa satellite channel were targeted. Al-Aqsa satellite channel was hit with an F-16 airstrike in the first hours of the war, and half an hour later, the TV channel was targeted. Three floors of the four-story building were totally destroyed. There was nobody in the building at that moment, but all the equipment and devices were destroyed in this sudden strike. There was a new fully equipped studio we were about to commence, but it was also destroyed. As soon as the war started, we evacuated the building and moved to another place where the satellite transmission vehicle parked there was also targeted. We used other alternatives to continue working, but this was very exhausting to our crews. Our colleague Fadl Shana'a was killed by the Israeli occupation tank shells while he was holding his camera and trying to document war crimes committed against Palestinian victims. This direct targeting of journalists continues, and it is the most dangerous type of violations that the occupation practices. Other violations include prevention from traveling and restricting freedom of movement. There are plenty of examples on that, like Abdul Latif Ghaith, one of the founders of the Journalist Syndicate, who has been prevented from leaving Jerusalem for years. Journalists suffer from other violations on a daily basis while covering events in the field.
The Israeli occupation committed various violations against Palestinian journalists and reporters, as some of them were prevented from coverage, traveling, and participation. The Israeli occupation is continuing these outrageous and inhumane practices.
The Israeli occupation uses various methods to target and humiliate Palestinian journalists, like banning coverage, breaking into their offices, harassing them on checkpoints, not permitting part of the crew to pass, and preventing coverage inside Al-Aqsa Mosque. In 2010 and 2011, all equipment and part of the footage were confiscated at the gates of Al-Aqsa Mosque multiple times. Footage and filled materials were also confiscated from the journalists covering the protests in Bel-Ain and other demonstrations against the apartheid wall and others. All the equipment and materials, like footage and films, were confiscated in all these events. The Israeli occupation tried everything with Palestinian journalists, from killing, targeting, and humiliation, but they could never break their determination and persistence. Otherwise, you would have seen Palestinian journalists run away and sit at home during the Israeli occupation's war in the Gaza Strip. But on the contrary, they have always been in the field, and their numbers are increasing. This shows that Palestinian journalists are ready to sacrifice for this just cause and to make the world see the truth. Everyone is a target, despite the immunity and protection provided for journalists by both the international humanitarian law and the Fourth Geneva Convention. There are two forms of protection. The first is that journalists are civilians and are entitled to all rights of civilians. The other form of protection is that provided by the Fourth Geneva Convention for journalists, women, and children under occupation or in armed conflict zones. Despite all that, we find that the Israeli occupation Federation does not respect the international humanitarian law, with the hideous help and bias of the United States and the silence that qualifies to a crime. All this encourages the Israeli occupation to carry on with its violations and not respect the minimum level of humanitarian principles and the international humanitarian law.
In the past 10 years, the Israeli occupation killed about 20 journalists, in addition to committing hundreds of physical and vocal violations and continuing hindering journalists and reporters from performing their jobs. In the last 3 years, between 2009 and 2011, the Israeli occupation committed 336 violations against journalists and media institutions and killed four journalists in early 2009 during the war.
Why does not the Israeli occupation target Israeli journalists who cover internal events and issues? Why are other journalists covering events in Europe or the United States not targeted? Palestinian journalists are the only ones to be targeted, and the United States is silent about it and provides cover for the occupation from being legally punished. I believe that what stopped the war on Gaza was the Palestinian journalist, not politicians or political negotiations. Journalists played a significant role in documenting and reporting the events. They were subject to a lot of pressure. Many of them were killed, their equipment was destroyed, and their offices were targeted. But they stood tall above all that and performed a significant job reporting the reality of the events and the suffering of their people to the whole world.
Despite this horrific amount of violations of the different international conventions, the international community did not react to these violations and did not hold the Israeli occupation accountable for these crimes and killings of journalists. This silence encouraged the occupation to continue their violations to prevent journalists and reporters from covering and documenting the various crimes committed against Palestinians.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hossein Latifi and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different Quranic teachings about the human being and the verses of the Holy Quran pertaining to humanity so that we can understand the Quranic and Islamic image of humanity and the plan that Islam has for the perfection and the journey toward perfection of this being. Now, in the previous episode, we said that in order to understand human being, we should understand different dimensions of the soul, and one of the dimensions was intellect, and then we said in order to understand, it was very important, significant role of intellect according to the verses of the Holy Quran, And we said that in order to understand what Quran means by intellect, we have to refer to the hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And we ended up reading one beautiful hadith from the Prophet that would give us an easy way to understand and to trace the signs of a person with perfect intellect. The hadith said, the intellect of a believer is not perfect until he has or he develops 10 virtues. So we covered some of these virtues in the previous episode, and some of them are left for this episode. And we said that all these virtues, when we go deeper, when we think about them, we can find the links between these virtues and the verses of the Holy Quran. So we arrived here. Another virtue that is a sign of a person with perfect intellect is that الذُّلُّ أَحَبُّ إِلَيْهِ مِنَ الْعِزِّ. Humility is more favorite to him than reputation or popularity. Now, this may create a question. Why popularity is bad? No, popularity is not bad. In fact, you might be surprised that the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for reputation. وَجَعَلِّي لِسَانَ صِدْقًا فِي الْآخِرِينَ. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala narrates that in Quran, telling us indirectly that this is an example you can take. You can ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for reputation and popularity. It's not bad as long as it is in the correct direction. Not popularity based on anything possible, but popularity in the virtues. It's not bad. But it's not the ultimate goal of a person. But this line says, it doesn't say popularity and reputation is bad. It says for a person with perfect intellect, humility is always more favorite. Why? Because the risks of falling when a person has high reputation is greater. What does it mean? The risk of falling, does it mean, for example, if I do some mistake, I fall from the eyes of people? That could be one of them, but not all of it. There is a hadith, there is a verse of the Holy Quran that praises, and there are different verses, but this one I like, that praises humility. وَعِبَادُ الرَّحْمَنَ الَّذِينَ يَمْشُونَ عَلَى الْأَرْضِ هَوْنًا وَإِذَا خَاطَبَهُمُ الْجَاهِلُونَ قَالُوا سَلَامًا. The servants of Ar-Rahman are those who walk with humility on earth. وَإِذَا خَاتَمُهُمُ الْجَاهِلُونَ. Even when they are addressed by ignorant people. Ignorant people, it doesn't mean people who lack knowledge. It means who lack intellect. Several times we said that the contrast between knowledge and jahl, ignorance, there is a contrast between intellect and jahl. So this one is, when they are treated unfairly, they don't lose their temper and they behave politely and they say salamun alaikum. And there's another verse that talks about people who are at the brink of making a great mistake. So we're going to have a break and come back to cover that verse.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. So in the first segment, we said, according to the hadith of the Prophet, a person with perfect intellect always prefers humility over reputation. And one reason for that could be the risk and the threats that are associated with reputation. And what are those threats? Some of them could be, yes, a person with high reputation and popularity is always under the focus and it's difficult, a spotlight. Yes, difficulty is there. But it's not all. According to the verses of the Holy Quran, there is another threat that exists for people that have superiority in any possible way. What is the verse? The verse says, تِلْكَ الدَّارُ الْآخِرَةِ نَجْعَلُهَا لِلَّذِينَ لَا يُرِدُونَ عُلُوًّا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا فَسَادًا. This is the house of eternity, referring to Jannah, referring to paradise. نَجْعَلُهَا, we have dedicated it, we have specifically put it and preserved it, reserved it. نَجَعَلُهَا لِلَّذِينَ لَا يُرِيدُونَ عُلُوًا, those who do not seek superiority over others. And there is a hadith that says that even if you feel proud of yourself because you have a new shoe, or even a shoelace, شِرَاكَ حِذَاءِهِ, meaning the shoelace, a person feels proud of himself because he has, I don't know, an expensive shoelace, and he will be an example of this verse. يُرِيدُونَ عُلُوًا فِي الْأَرْضِ. He feels superior to others. He walks as if he has owned, for example, what? Because you have a shoe, you become proud of yourself. وَلَا فَسَادَ, and they don't look for corruption. Reputation and being in a position at the center of attention is not bad in itself, but it has this difficulty that you do not have such a feeling. It's not always people who have popularity and reputation, they have such a feeling. No, no. Many good people could hold themselves, could control themselves. And yes, they are popular, but they don't have such feeling in themselves to feel superior, to feel holier than thou, or no. But it is possible, very possible, for people in such positions, if you have, I don't know, nowadays we have different examples of this. If you have, I don't know, thousands of followers in the social media, if you do this, and you feel like you're someone. And the verse says, لَا يُرِيدُونَ عُلُوًا. Specifically and exclusively, the house of eternity are for those who never wish to be superior. لَا يُرِيدُونَ عُلُوًا. Any kind of عُلُوًا. عُلُوًا has تَنْوِيمٍ, means any kind of superiority. Superiority in terms of their wealth, superiority in terms of... No, as long as a decent life is there, they don't want to show off, they don't want to brag, they don't want to show that I'm better than thou and you. So this is why أَذُّلُّ أَحَبُّ إِلَيْهِ مِنَ الْعَيْزِ, why a person with perfect reason prefers always to be humble, because he has the fear that he might be an example of those people who seek superiority to others. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us always be on the right path. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa alin nabiyil azim. اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee have pledged to deploy 100,000 attorneys and volunteers to monitor the upcoming presidential vote next November. Democrats and election experts say that figure is unrealistic and have expressed concern the effort could hamper normal election operations and intimidate American voters. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican National Committee and former President Donald Trump's campaign announced a new initiative on Friday, 19th of April, to deploy thousands of monitor vote counting in battleground states during the presidential election. The Republican Party aims to recruit 100,000 volunteers to observe the voting process and report irregularities, as well as lawyers to provide rapid response services if there are issues in vote counting. The Republican National Committee is hiring hundreds of election integrity staff across the map more than ever before because our party will be recruiting thousands of more observers to protect the vote in 2024, according to Lara Trump, Republican National Committee co-chair, in a press release. Lara Trump added, these campaign officials in states are tasked with recruiting, training, and when possible, shifting poll watchers and poll workers day in and day out. The operation plans to set up an election integrity hotline in every battleground state and create a command center for lawyers to respond to reports from volunteers. There will also be monthly training sessions on monitoring voting sites and ballot counting centers, according to the press release. The Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee are calling it the most extensive and monumental election integrity program in the nation's history. Every jurisdiction in the country allows people to observe, but not interfere, with the voting and counting process, according to David Becker, CBS News election law contributor and the founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David Becker doubts that Republicans will be able to attract as many volunteers for the effort as they have claimed. Transparency in elections is a good thing, David Becker said, but I don't recall a single presidential election in recent memory where there weren't promises of recruiting an army of thousands of poll watchers, and those have never materialized. The program was designed by the Trump campaign, along with newly installed Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Whatley, Lara Trump, and Republican National Committee Chief Counsel Charlie Spies. Before Trump selected him to the chair of the Republican National Committee, Michael Whatley worked on election integrity initiatives as the chair of the North Carolina Republican Party. His history with these efforts was a motivating factor for Donald Trump when he selected him to succeed Ronald McDaniel as party chair. The announcement underscores an effort by former President Trump to refocus the Republican National Committee on election integrity, which Trump felt previous party leaders failed to accomplish during the 2020 presidential election. Despite Donald Trump's focus on the issue, there was no evidence of widespread fraud during the 2020 presidential election. Trump is currently facing federal and state charges relating to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The Democratic National Committee, the DNC, accused the Trump political operation of trying to undermine the results of the 2024 presidential election. Donald Trump knows he's running a losing campaign, so he's working with his hand-picked team of election deniers at the Republican National Committee to once again lay the groundwork to undermine our democracy and spread baseless lies about a rigged election. According to Alex Floyd, the Democratic National Committee Rapid Response Director. The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. Donald Trump's presidential campaign and the Republican National Committee, the RNC, announced a massive election integrity operation on Friday, 19th of April, promising to deploy 100,000 volunteers and attorneys to battleground states to protect the vote and ensure a big win next November. In a press release, officials said they wanted the volunteers and lawyers to monitor logic and accuracy testing, early voting, ballot tabulation, mail ballot processing and election day voting, as well as post-election canvassers, audits and recounts. The release suggests they may intend to recruit poll workers as well. Having the right people to count the ballots is just as important as turning out voters on election day, Donald Trump said in his press release. The Republican National Committee is hiring hundreds of election integrity staff across the map, more than ever before, because our party will be recruiting thousands of more observers to protect the upcoming vote in 2024. These campaign officials in states are tasked with recruiting, training, and when possible, shifting poll watchers and poll workers day in and day out, according to RNC's co-chair, Lara Trump. Poll watching is a normal part of the elections. Both parties do it, but experts warn that unruly operations can be a problem. And as Donald Trump and his allies continue to make false claims about the 2020 election, some experts worry that the empowering these sort of observers at polling sites could hamper normal election operations or even intimidate American voters. The GOP released notes they plan to work with passionate grassroots coalitions who are deeply invested in fighting voter fraud. The planned operation would double the Republican National Committee's promised 50,000-person operation from 2020 presidential election, though some experts said both figures were aspirational and unrealistic. The Republican National Committee did not respond to a request for data on how many people had volunteered or been staffed in recent elections.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers that you'll be hearing today are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Shahri. And to help us with our questions, we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Salaam alaikum, Brother Miqdad. We've had some very nice discussions with you. Thanks for showing up again.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. I enjoyed it thoroughly as well. Thanks.
So we've been talking about how we can encourage our children to do right things and refrain from doing wrong things, considering that rationality isn't their most powerful feature, especially when they're under 8. We're talking about various ways to do that, and the last element that we were talking about was storytelling. And in our previous program, we talked about the practical elements to a storytelling, like the specificity, like the words that we use, the vocabulary that we use. Remember that you said that the story should be completed, children cannot bear to be left in a suspense, and other elements like that. Let's start today by examining the rest of the elements that we need to consider when we're telling stories to our children.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We talked about how to use the right words, words that are simple for children to understand. We talked about how to make sure that sentences are small, that they're linked together properly in a way that is very quick to the children can quickly understand it. They don't have to think about it too much. We talked about how the tune and the body language is extremely important, the voice change that we do to ensure that we are in sync with the story, basically, the content of the story. Right, so this is a huge. I don't want to open up over here, but there's so much we can talk about. Right, for example, when you're saying a story and the story is something to do something fast, then you make you speed up the way you speak saying it. Right, the horse was going really fast. Right, but when you talk about something that's happening very slow, You slow down. Suddenly, he came to his friend and he started talking to him very slowly.
We also talked about, I remember, making the voices of the animals, or if any sound is actually there, replicating that sound.
Definitely, yeah. Replicating sound is very good as well. You're making the story very alive. One of our teachers was saying that he was challenging the crowd he was speaking to. I think one of the questions was about animations and cartoons. So you're saying you can put a TV on one side of the room, okay, and I'll be sitting on the other side of the room, and I promise you, he challenged everyone that if you put 10 kids on that side watching TV, okay, I'll say stories over here, and I challenge you that all 10 of them will be with me at the end of the show, listening to my stories and abandoning the TV. And for some parents, it might be very surprising that isn't that even possible to get my children out of the screen. But the way he was saying that, the way we need to do stories is to make them very alive. And this is by making these noises, by making these changes in the tone of the voice and in the body language, etc. Another thing that we talked about was to involve children in the story as well. This especially for stories that you repeat, that are repeated stories. Now, in bracket, let me mention something over here, is that children, especially when they're very young, when they're 3, 4, 5, they love to hear stories over and over and over again, the same story, right? You could play this, if it's a very good story, they probably want to hear it every single night for the next month and a half or two. Right, and they won't get tired. You might be tired, you might get fed up of listening to that story, but they don't. They want to repeat it and again and again and again. And there's pleasure in that for them, right? But one of the things that you could do is when the story is known by them, after a few times you've played, then they know the story. Then is to involve the children in the story. So let them do part of the story. Let them, for example, make the noise of the horse. Or, for example, let them do the voice of Amir al-Mu'mineen, for example. Make them part of the story. This really makes the story much fun, much more lively for them, and makes them feel much more in control of as well. And that really builds the role model aspect as well.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you there, but we'll be back after the break to examine more elements when we're telling stories. Stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I've got a favorite game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're with Brother Maghdad. We're talking about the various elements that we should consider when we are telling stories to children. So keep the sentences short, involve the children, have proper body language, sync your tune with the story, and it's okay if the children ask you to repeat a story 100 times, they'll enjoy it. What else should we consider about storytelling?
One point about involving children, allowing them to speak during the story as well, is very important. You know, sometimes you wonder why do grandmas or uncles are much more closer to children, especially, I mean, children love being around their grandmothers or around their uncles and aunties. One of the reasons is that because they listen to them, right? Parents usually tend to say, you know, be quiet, you've spoken a lot today. I've got a lot of things to do, stop talking, right? It's enough now. But the same thing when they go to the uncle, and then it's normal to some extent because they're going to see the uncle for an hour, right? And the uncle or the auntie or the grandma is very happy to see them. So they're going to allow them to speak. And children, they feel really respected because they're allowed to speak and they're listened to, basically. So when we do stories, it's good to listen. Sometimes children have questions and then children want to interrupt and say, how about we do it different way? Sometimes they want to do the story themselves, they want to carry on the story. It's good to allow them this freedom to say it and to express themselves and to listen to them attentively.
That does actually kind of point to one of the questions that I wanted to ask. At some point, we might want our children to change the story to their liking in order to invoke their creativity. But if it's a story about the history of Islam, they will be diverting that story from its reality. Is that okay to let them do that?
So if it's a real story that happened, then no, it's not okay to completely change it. But you can have some additions that don't really matter to the story too much, right? So for example, inshallah, I'll mention this story that, for example, if Kumail, the companion of Amir al-Mu'minin, is sitting in the mosque, for example, and Amir al-Mu'minin grabs his hand and says, let's go out, right? Now if your child wants to say, it was really, really dark, and the moon was out, right? And when they walked, for example, Kumail just tripped on something, right? It's fine, right? It's a kind of details that don't really have an impact on the story that we want to tell. And actually makes it more lively, makes it more real.
So we were saying that sometimes it's okay that the children might want to take over and narrate the stories themselves, and yeah, That's okay for them to do, let them interact.
Another thing that really helps when you do this is that you appreciate how much they've understood as well. Sometimes children, if you want to test if children got the message of the story or not, rather than asking them directly, did you understand the story? And they'll say, yes, we understood. Or asking them, what did you learn from the story? You ask them to repeat the story. And when they repeat the story, you realize which part they really took in, and that's the word they're going to say, and which part they forgot and they put it aside. Another thing about stories is to sometimes act them out, right? By using different kind of tools around us. One of the parents was saying that when they were doing the story of Imam Ali in the Battle of Khandaq, the Battle of Ahzab, the other name is, and when Amir al-Mu'minin fought one of the strongest soldiers on that side, they took two chairs and pretended that they were on the horse, basically, right? You act it out, basically, and that children really appreciate that. And that really helps make the story go in. Stories is something that children will never forget. If you want to teach them something that they don't forget, it's through stories. And up until now, I'm sure a lot of us remember, if I ask you one of the lectures that you heard as an adult, if I tell you about the last lecture that you listened to, you probably remember the story that was mentioned in that lecture more than all the rest of the content. So stories really help, and the more we make it lively, the more we make it reach the heart, the goal of the story will be reached.
And when we're talking about, specifically when we're talking about appreciating and acknowledging a child's understanding of the story, at this age, under 10, would it be appropriate to ask them what they learned from the story and how they can apply it to their real life?
You could, but it's always best to let them do it themselves, right? If you point it out too much, it turns into a school lesson, right? And children don't necessarily want to constantly be told what to do or not to do. And so they won't appreciate so much if after every story I have to tell you what's the right thing, what's the wrong thing, etc. Allow the worldview of the story, the very strong etiquettes of the story to sink in their hearts without being noticed. Sometimes it doesn't need to be noticed. It'll play in their mind themselves. And when the time comes for that to be adapted or applied in practical life, it will naturally come out.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to come after the break. Don't go away.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, O nation of Shia, teach your children the poems of Al-Abdi, because he was a follower of the religion of Allah.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are with Brother Mighdad. We're talking about storytelling to children. So up to now, we've been talking about telling stories of Islamic history in order to acquaint our children with Islamic identity. What if we want to teach them about Islamic values? And the question that I want to ask specifically is that since these are stories that are made up, would it be appropriate for us to use the heroes that children have in the animations that they see on television, like Ben 10 and whatever, in order to tell them a story about Islamic values?
So if you remember that in the past show that we were specifically mentioning that the real reason that we want to use stories is to make the Ahlul Bayt as role models for our children. And we said that one of the best ways, or perhaps the most efficient way, to get our children to learn about Islam and to become strong followers of the Ahlul Bayt and to become true servants of Allah, which is the goal of their creation, is through the path of role modeling, right? As we mentioned that if you want a 9-year-old girl to wear hijab, okay, you can sit her down and explain to her that if you wear hijab, this is, Islam says this, it's because you'll be more respected, or because this, and you can give her like 5-6 arguments for it, right? But if this child has Bibi Fatima as a role model, all you need to say is that, do you know what? Bibi Fatima used to wear her hijab, and that's it. Just the way that you have one, I don't know, a football player, for example, who makes one hairstyle and suddenly thousands of people have the same hairstyle without even asking, does this even look good, right? There's a 100% following to that person because it's a role model. Similarly, Islam has introduced for us role models, and we have this in Holy Quran, that and through the role models, we get our children to become really good, strong followers of the Ahlul Bayt. So the real reason of stories is to get them to follow the Ahlul Bayt, and therefore we stick to the stories that are related to the Ahlul Bayt.
And in 30 seconds, can you answer this question? Should our parents be investing in criticizing these animations that are not related to the Ahlul Bayt?
In one sense, no, because if you do spend more time on the Ahlul Bayt, the rest will just fly away and fade away by itself.
Okay, thank you very much. That's even shorter than 30 seconds, which is great. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. But if you missed the program, you can always download an archive of this episode and previous ones from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. And find our page on Call of Islam. And you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir, englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems, Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life. A complete way, it's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.